about that. So don't hide so far. We can sit there, yeah, so that you can see members of the public, members of the media, you are all welcome to check. You know, the reason we asked the CSIR to come here is because since last week we had a presentation from the Department of Energy on the Integrated Energy Plan and the Integrated Resource Plan. Some of you were here. In the context of that, we have we would be having a program to look at, in particular into the question of the UT as part of the South Africa's energy mix. All of you know this is a debate has been raging for a while now. We have promised in the past that we'd come back and have some discussion about the necessity, the wisdom, or otherwise, of this as part of our energy mix. At some point, we will have some of the distinguished guests who are here to come back, not to present us their findings, but to tell us what they think of this of nuclear as part of South Africa's energy mix. From our side of the portfolio committee, we do want to engage in a thorough discussion on this matter. And I do know that quite views there in public with regard to this government steaming ahead, this government going to continue. And last week we were with the Department of Energy here presenting the Integrated Energy Plan and the IRP. So we asked them, so what do you mean by these new time frames with regard to UK as opposed to what is in the IRP and what Eskom seems to be doing? So, which is what? They said they'll come back to us. They can't tell. I know that the gentleman sitting here said, well, as far as we are concerned, we are working on the basis of the 2010 IRP now. So, things are still unclear. So it was our intention that at some point we'll get Eskom here in the Department of Energy to explain to us exactly what is going on, what the plans are. So I'm sure the executive here will inform us when we are ready to have a discussion in the presence of Eskom so that they can clarify to us exactly what they do in regard to this particular matter of the of nuclear procurement. But today we're going to be listening to the experts here to tell us about what they've been doing and their findings and what they think of the what are the scenarios with regard to South Africa's electricity. So that's all we're going to be doing today. So we'll have enough time to engage with the discussion. Let's get apologies, and after that we'll allow CSR to give us the presentation. I see there's a gentleman sitting there from the presidency. Maybe one day we should ask them, actually. instead of asking ESCOM or the DOE to ask them from the president, what's happening exactly? Maybe the answer must come from the Senate.
Thank you, Chair. Just the following apologies. Mr. Mackay is requesting to leave the cloud to the Chair's other urgent meeting that he will attend to. And then I've just been informed that Mrs. Mohamed Salah will not be able to attend the meeting as well. And then Mrs. Farku is running late, she will be joining us. And then we also received an apology from the Minister of Energy, who is unable to attend the meeting due to other urgent meetings that she has to attend. And then also an apology from the Deputy Minister, who is attending the military day in Durban to get here. Those are the apologies.
Thank you very much, Chair, for the opportunity to address you, the honourable members, our colleagues from ESCOM, the DEA, and others from the Presidency. We're here with the team to talk about some of our research findings on possible scenarios in the energy space. The presentation will be delivered by my colleague, Dr. Tobias Nims-Bishop, and I will let him and perhaps the members of our technical team just mention their names at a high level. With your permission, Chief.
Can you use this one? Yeah, that's much better. Thank you very much, Chair, honorable members. It's a great pleasure to be able to address you today and to share our research findings with you on different electricity scenarios for South Africa. The delegation that we have here is headed by our group executive, Dr. Rachel Chikwamba, and then we have the full technical team here that is working on the topics that we are presenting, and we have our parliamentary liaison, our communications managers with us as well. Maybe before we go into the details of this very presentation, just on one slide, we would like to highlight to you that
I don't want to know colleagues.
Chair, we have a slide in the later in the slide deck that goes into the specific technical capabilities of the individuals. If I may postpone it to that slide, with your permission.
I've seen that. I don't want to put the faces to what I saw in the slide.
Thank
you. Can do that at that point, it's okay.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. I think we'll let them mention their names very quickly, please.
Joanne Collins, Mama Lucas and Adler.
Jared Wright, and I'm a principal engineer at CSR. Crescent Mishwana, I'm the research group leader for energy systems planning group.
And I'm Dendani Tetho, responsible for communications at CSR.
Good morning, honourable members. It's Aziza Fredericks from the CSR Parliamentary Office.
Good morning, Chair and honourable members. I'm Elia Matikane, also from the Parliamentary Office.
Okay. So before we go into the details of the presentation, we would just like to flag on one slide what the energy research at the CSR is all about, what topics we cover. The purpose of this slide being to show to the members that we are doing energy research along the entire value chain, starting from energy technologies on the demand side, energy efficiency and demand response. On the supply side, we are looking at new energy technologies that are on the supply side, renewable technologies, conventional technologies. We are doing technology research and technology demonstration on the energy storage side. And then one of the five areas that we are doing research on is the research area of energy systems, where Crescent Mushwana is our research group leader, and that's basically the research group that is delivering the content of that presentation today. So the feedback on the IRP and this presentation that we are giving today is part of the research on energy systems in this five research areas that we are busy with at the CSR. Before we go into the details of our study and our finding, just some global background. What you see on this slide is the annual new capacity, the annual capacity additions for the two predominant renewable energy technologies that have been deployed in the last 15 to 16 years across the globe. Solar photovoltaics, solar PV in yellow, and wind technology in blue. And you basically see the new capacity that has been added somewhere in the world to the grid in gigawatts since 2000. You can see that these two technologies, which seem very familiar to us today, are still very new technologies. In 2000, 4 gigawatts of wind power was added globally to the global system, where the South African power system size is 45 gigawatts. So in a global context, these 4 gigawatts were really small and not a lot of capacity. That ramped up in the 2000s, in the early 2000s, and now in 2016, 124 gigawatts of new solar PV and wind were added globally to the grid. That development was driven in the first decade from 2000 to 2010, around about 2012, was driven by subsidies that were poured into these technologies, into development of these technologies that let the market grow. The market growth led to mass manufacturing, led to technology improvements, and subsequently, if we overlay the cost development in relative terms of these two technologies over the last 8 years, led to a significant cost reduction for both solar PV and wind. So normalized to 100%, where the 100% is in 2008, wind technology has reduced by roughly 35% in the last 8 years, and solar PV technology costs have reduced by almost 80% in the last 8 years. So what that means, if you see this build out and overlay the cost reductions, you can basically differentiate two phases of global renewable energy deployment. First phase, literally up until 3 to 4 years ago, subsidy-driven phase where the early starters in renewables invested subsidy money basically into the deployment of these technologies. Roughly in 2014, 2015, because of the cost reduction, solar PV and wind are now cost competitive in many markets. It depends on the solar and the wind resource, but South Africa is one of the markets where these two technologies are fully cost competitive, and we are basically moving, we are beyond the tipping point where subsidies are not required for these two technologies anymore. If we zoom into South Africa, South Africa has started with the Renewable Energy Independent Power Producer Procurement Program in 2011. The first projects came online in 2013, and what you see on this slide is the capacity that was online of solar PV, wind, and concentrated solar power connected to the South African grid at end of the year from 2013 to 2016. So by end of last year, December 2016, we had 3,100 megawatts, roughly 3.1 gigawatt of solar PV, wind, and CSP operational in the South African system. These capacities produce energy, of course, in terawatt hours and kilowatt hours, and the amount of electric energy that they produced, a similar ramp up you can see. Last year, almost 7 terawatt hours from solar PV, wind, and CSP was produced and feeding into the South African grid. Now, of course, we have to put that into perspective. Only relative statements have absolute validity. So in that sense, let's put it into perspective to what the total system demand is in South Africa. Last year, in 2016, the total system load was roughly 238 terawatt hours. A total system load is basically all domestic customer demand plus the export demand. That's the total load on the power system. And of the 238 terawatt hours, roughly 7 terawatt hours came from solar PV, wind, and CSP, which is approximately 3% of the total demand. So essentially, within 3 years of deployment time, 3% were added to the South African grid from renewables, which is roughly a 1 percentage point increase per year, just to give you a sense of the speed of deployment. And we would say in a global context that's a relatively fast speed of deployment, especially for a country that is that has basically started the deployment and is not and doesn't have a long experience curve yet. So from that perspective, it's a relatively fast deployment. Now on the costing side, now again moving into South Africa, not global numbers but now South African numbers, the deployment of solar PV and wind in South Africa through the competitive auction program in form of the REAP, the REI quadruple P, led to very tangible cost results on the for all new technologies, but on this slide showing solar PV and wind specifically. In the first bid window that was submitted in November 2011, the average tariff for solar PV was still 3 rand and 65 cents, still very high. For wind, 1 rand and 51 cents. That's the average tariff for all projects that submitted a bid in the first bid window. And this average tariff moved down very quickly in March 2012, already significantly lower. And then in November 2015, that was the date when the latest bid window was submitted. That's the so-called bid window 4 expedited. And in bid window 4 expedited was for the first time in South Africa, and then I think that's almost a global precedent, that that solar PV and wind came in at the same cost. So we are basically at the tipping point of the cost between solar PV and wind. So November 2015, 62 cents. Were submitted as the average tariffs for both solar PV and wind, which means an 80% cost reduction from 4 years ago, November 2011, for solar PV, and almost 60% cost reduction on the wind side. Now, if we compare these 62 cents to alternative new build options, that's always a bit tricky and difficult, because if you look at these tariffs that need to be paid and compare other technologies either from other countries or from different commercial settings, then you never know exactly why are there differences. Are there differences because of the underlying technology, or are there differences because of a different risk profile, because a certain project was built in a different commercial setup than than the solar PV and the wind projects. Now, last year in October, the department announced the first competitively procured coal project from independent power producers. That's what you see on the right-hand side, baseload coal IPP program. And the announced tariff for this project was 1 rand and 3 cents, including the same scope of work as the wind and the PV projects, meaning the shallow grid connection costs and the owner's development costs. So that's all, it's an all-in tariff. And now it's basically for the first time in South Africa that we have three different technologies, three different tariffs on a completely comparative basis. The commercial setting is exactly the same for all three projects. Eskom is the off-taker. It's a long-term take-or-pay contract. It's the same government guarantees underlying these three projects. So literally everything is the same for these three tariffs that you see here. The only difference is the underlying technology. And that basically gives us very good indication that new wind and new solar PV is roughly 40% cheaper in South Africa than new coal projects. Now with this background, let's move into our own work and into our approach that we have taken, and then we will get to our project team one more time. First of all, some background on the integrated resource plan on a very conceptual level. What the IRP does is we have a planning and a simulation world. That's the upper layer. In the planning and simulation world, at the core of that, we have the so-called IRP model, the software platform that is used to run the IRP model is called Plexos. Of course, other software platforms could be used as well, but in South Africa, Eskom and the department and ourselves have decided to use Plexos. It's a software package commercially available that is used by power system planners and power system operators across the globe. And what that model does is it runs a mathematical least cost optimization. It's a techno-economical optimization of the power system. So you feed your input assumptions into the model, and the most important input assumptions are things like your demand forecast. Of course, how much electricity do we consume in the next 30, 40 years to come? That has a significant implication on how much power generators do we need to build. So the demand forecast is one of the most important inputs. Similarly important, the set of technology cost assumptions. So what we discussed in the previous chapter, what does solar PV and wind cost compared to coal, compared to nuclear, compared to gas? So all the different supply options that we have need to be costed, and the technical characteristics of these technologies need to feed into that model. And then we have some constraints that can be put in place, for example, the CO2 limits. And the CO2 limit basically says the power system is not allowed to emit more than the following amount of CO2 emissions. That could be a constraint in the model. With all these inputs, you feed them into the mathematical least cost optimization tool, and the output is then the capacity expansion plan that tells us what is the cheapest way of producing power reliably in the next 35 years, all the way until the planning horizon, let's say it's 2050, in the South African power system. What then the final IRP typically is, then after this least cost case has been developed, there are usually policy adjustments, because what comes out of the model as a pure least cost optimization is a pure outcome of a techno-economical assessment that captures any and all first order cost effects that can be accounted for in the power system. If there are aspects related to certain scenarios that are not captured in the model, then that's something that can and needs to be discussed in policy adjustments after the fact. And that's after the least cost has been adjusted, that's typically what comes out as the IRP, which then forms the capacity expansion plan for the country. That plan then moves as input into the actuals, into the real world. So now we are leaving the simulation world. And here the capacity expansion plan basically gets more formalized in ministerial determinations by the Department of Energy, by the minister, where the minister literally takes the plan, the IRP, and looks at the build-out that is required for the next 10 years and makes a determination that says, well, I determine that in the next 3 years we will procure 2 gigawatts of gas-fired power stations, for example. And that then moves into the procurement process. The procurement process so far has been competitive tender process, the REIPPP or the coal IPP program, or, of course, the procurement can happen on the ESCOM side as well. The outcomes of this procurement are now real-world results, which means a list of preferred bidders, technology allocations, megawatt allocations, and very important, that's why they are highlighted in red, we now, out of this procurement process, we now get actual technology costs, as opposed to the technology cost assumptions that we feed into the mathematical model at the very beginning of this process. Now, in terms of the IRP process, a slightly different chart, but similar to the first one. What usually happens in an IRP, and that's the way it's described in the IRP, in the current IRP version as well, is that there's least cost base case derived from pure technical planning facts. That's what I mentioned on the previous slide as being the techno-economical optimization, and that then usually forms the least cost base case. That basically tells us, if we are only concerned about effects and costs in the power system, this is the cheapest way to produce our power. And then, because, as I said, there might be certain aspects that are not captured in the model, we might want to look at different scenarios where we deviate on purpose from the least cost base case. And per definition, because the least cost base case is the outcome of a least cost mathematical optimization, if we deviate from least cost, we increase the total cost. That must be the case from a pure technical perspective. So if we, for example, we can put a constraint in place and limit the amount of renewables that can be built in the system, that's scenario one, that increases the cost and we can quantify what the cost is by putting a constraint in. Or we can force in certain technologies that might not be part of the least cost, of the pure least cost base case, nuclear, concentrated solar power, biogas, hydro, or others. And by pushing them in, we increase the total cost of the power system, and we can quantify by how much do we increase the cost. Or we can make an assessment, what if we want to decarbonize the South African power system by 2050 entirely? We have an advanced CO2 cap decline. We can model it, we deviate from these costs, and we can quantify how much the cost is. And at the end, we basically get a table where we have our base case. We say, with all the planning assumptions that we have, this is the cheapest way of producing power in South Africa. With all the different scenarios, the total cost of these scenarios will be base cost plus an amount X billion rand per year. And this can be quantified. Then that moves into the public consultation on costed scenarios, policy adjustments of the base case, and that leads into the final IRP. Now, so much to the process. Now, what we have done now, the background, the IRP is currently being updated. The IRP 2016 is currently in the process of being developed, and we have seen from the first draft that was published in November last year that there is a limitation in the base case, which is the amount of wind and solar PV capacity that the model is allowed to build per year in any given year is limited. In the plan that was published in November, we don't see a techno-economical reason for that limitation. So therefore, we have embarked on a study where we do scenario analysis of the South African power system. An important difference that we model compared to the IRP is that we don't put new build limits on renewables, wind, solar, PV, nor on any other technology for that matter. So we are running our own least cost case, and we basically let the model run and let the model tell us what would you model want to build the cheapest power system, and then we look at the results and decide afterwards what we do with the results. And the scope of our study, just to make that clear again, it's a pure techno-economical optimization of the costs that are directly incurred within the power system. And then we take two scenarios from the draft IRP 2016, one called the draft IRP 2016 base case, and then the draft IRP 2016 carbon budget, and our own base case we call the least cost case. terms of the software platform that we use, I mentioned it before, it's called Plexos. We don't have to go into the details of this slide unless later you have specific questions on the modeling tool. But I think the main point to make is that this Plexus software was designed for optimizing power systems in the long run for long-term capacity expansion planning, and therefore, because it was designed for that, it captures all relevant costs that are associated to the power system. So all first-order costs are captured, and there are no hidden costs that are not covered in the model, which might have such a magnitude that they would flip the outcome. All first order costs are covered in the model. But as I said, if you have a more detailed question about the model, we have if we move to the next slide, we have our modeling team here in the room. So let me just quickly go through the names one more time so that you know what the individuals are doing. We have on the right-hand side, our modeling team, Joanne, Mamash Loco, and Charat, all three experts in using of the software platform Plexos. Joanne was previously with ESCOM in the energy planning department, and she was one of the team members who actually ran the integrated resource plan in previous versions, the IRP 2013, who produced the medium-term outlook on behalf of the regulator using the same software platform Plexos that we are using now as well. Mamash Loco was previously a researcher with the Energy Research Center here at UCT, involved in energy planning as well. Jarrod, also a very, very strong expert on the Plexos platform. He was previously the Africa manager for Plexos, which included giving training sessions and training programs for Plexos users across the African continent. So he advised a number of African system operators and power system planners on the use of Plexos. He's also a member of the National Planning Commission, and they're responsible for he's the energy commissioner there. On the left-hand side, we have myself. I worked with ESCOM before I joined the CSR, and I was part of the team that developed the IRP 2010 and IRP 2013. I'm a member of MACE, the Ministerial Advisory Council on Energy. And then we have on the operations side, we have Robbie van Heerden in our team. He's the only one who couldn't join us today, unfortunately. And he was for more than a decade the head of the system operator in ESCOM, so he was responsible for running for actually day-to-day operation of the entire South African power system. And then we have Crescent, the research group leader responsible for the whole team looking at energy systems. And he was previously chief engineer in ESCOM, responsible for strategic transmission grid planning. So he covers all the aspects that are related to grid implications of the different scenarios that we are looking at. So with this small background on the team, if there are any specific questions on the grid, on system operations, on stability, or on energy planning in general, I think we have the right team members in the room to answer the questions. Now, moving on to the IRP and our comments on the IRP assumptions, we basically have two comments to make. The one is the smaller comments, because it doesn't affect the outcome that much, and we will see that later. But it's nevertheless something where we want to adjust the numbers in our own planning. So it's about the cost inputs for solar PV and wind. The comments that we would like to give here is, or it's best explained if we compare what the IRP 2010 had assumed as cost inputs for both solar PV and wind. So what you see on this slide is the average tariff as a proxy for the cost assumptions that go into the model. The Plexos model doesn't really see tariffs, so that's not the input assumption as such, but the cost inputs that go into the model basically result in this type of tariff. So it's a proxy for the cost inputs that feed into the model. And in the IRP 2010, which was developed during 2010, so at the very beginning of the x-axis, these were the cost assumptions for solar PV that went into the model back then in the IRP 2010. So there was already in the IRP 2010 an assumption that the cost for solar PV would reduce in the very near future. The planning assumption came from 1 rand 40 to 2 rand roughly, and the IRP 2010 assumed that by 2030 the costs for PV would be in the range of 50 cents. So at the time, if you remember the very first slide, how much PV had already been installed globally, that was still a time when not much PV had been installed on a global scale, and nothing literally had been installed within South Africa. So at the time, it was a very ambitious, let me put it this way, a planning assumption. Seeing what's happening in this industry globally, but nevertheless, it had not materialized yet. If we now overlay the actual cost results from the IPP tariffs that have been achieved in South Africa, put them into the same monetary terms, April 2016 rand, then you see the between 04 and 91 cents on average approached very quickly, the actuals approached very quickly the cost assumptions, and the 91 cents was in 2014 at the lower boundary of what the IRP 2010 had assumed, and Bitwindow 4 expedited, the 62 cents is now significantly below this cost funnel of what the IRP 2016 had assumed. So from our perspective, we would say the actual costs that have been achieved at the least confirm the cost assumptions that the IRP 2010 had made. Now, the cost assumptions that go into the IRP 2016, applying the same conversion from cost into tariffs, is the red one. So the IRP 2016 basically uses the same cost assumption for 2015 as the IRP 2010 did, but then has a reduced cost reduction potential that is assumed to materialize until 2030, and as a result, the effective cost over the planning horizon effectively increase for solar PV. Because whatever the costs are today in a long-term plan that goes until 2050 is not the most important number. The most important number is what do we assume the cost to be over the planning horizon for the next 35 years. We will tell you later what cost assumptions do we use compared to IRP 2010 and IRP 2016. Now, on the wind side, again, the same logic. What did the IRP 2010 assume? IRP 2010 did not assume a cost funnel. It assumed just one technology and just one profile, so therefore also only one cost was assumed, roughly 80 cents going down to 75 cents by 2030. That was the assumption in the IRP 2010. Now the actuals, Bitwindow 4, already below the cost assumption of IRP 2010, and Bitwindow 4 expedited with the 62 cents significantly below the assumption that was made for the year 2030. IRP 2016 now introduces a number of different load factors for wind, so therefore a result is that we have a cost funnel now, we have a minimum and a maximum, and the minimum cost is more or less what the IRP 2010 had assumed. The maximum is a bit higher, so this is, you could say IRP 2016 basically stays with the cost assumption as they were in the IRP 2010. Also, the way we would look at it is that the actual tariffs have on the wind side over confirmed the cost assumptions of the IRP 2010. But this is the topic of the cost assumptions. The cost assumption is really, it's almost a scientific debate around the cost assumption, because it will inform what the different scenarios cost at the end of the day, but it doesn't affect the outcome. What does affect the outcome are the limitations that are put on the build-out rates for solar PV and wind. And now I want to elaborate a little bit more what these limitations are. So the current IRP model, as it was published in November last year, imposes an annual new build limit on solar PV and wind. And what that means is that the model is not allowed to build more capacity of solar PV or wind in any given year than these limits. If you look at the table in the third column, you see what the new build limit for solar PV is each and every year. It's 1,000 megawatt per year. Further to the right, the new build limit for wind is 1,600 megawatt per year. So that's a mathematical constraint that is imposed on the model, and the model is never allowed to build more than that in any given year. Now we did a small analysis and compared the new build limit to the size of the 916 megawatts. By 2050, the size of the power system almost doubles to 86 gigawatts. Now, the new build limits stay constant. And from our perspective, well, two comments on that. The first comment is we don't see a techno-economical justification for the new build limits in the first place. And secondly, if we impose a new build limit for any technology, whether it's wind or PV or any other technology, then this new build limit should be relative to the size of the power system, because in the year 2020, when we have 45 gigawatt system, it's from any dimension that you want to look at it, it's more difficult to introduce 1,000 megawatt of PV than in 2050 when the system has 86 gigawatt in size. So that's why we calculated the relative new build limits in the columns in the middle and to the very right as percentage compared to the size of the power system. So in 2020, the model is able to add 2.2% of the size of the power system in form of solar PV. By 2050, it's only able to add 1.2%. So the new build limits are in fact, effectively, they are not constant. They are actually decreasing, because we say that relative to the size of the power system, we are able to introduce less as time progresses. Now, if we compare these new build limits to what other countries over the last decade have already done, then let me explain to you what you see on this slide. You see the two black lines are the new build limits for solar PV as they are imposed in the IRP model in the year 2030 and in the year 2050. So it's 1.7% in 2030 and 1.2% in 2050. The bar chart shows you how much other countries, and that's a non-comprehensive selection of countries who have moved very fast with renewables, how much other countries compared to their respective power system size have installed in the last 10 years. So Germany started with 4% in 2007, then 2%, 5%, 9%, and then Italy came with an outlier of 17% of solar PV in just 1 year that was added to the power system, and now we have a wave of follower countries in yellow, the UK, Australia, Japan. They are adding now in recent years between 5, 6, 7% of their power system size in form of PV. And then we have a follower second wave. You could argue, if you remember the cost slide on the very beginning, you could argue that the follower second wave are actually the smart countries, because they are investing into solar PV now that the costs have reduced by 80% and not in the very beginning anymore, when the costs were high. But even China, with the large, massive power system that China has installed 2% of new solar PV in the last 2 years. And that contrasts to our new build limits by 2030 of 1.7%. On the wind side, similar picture. The new build limits are slightly higher. So it's 2.8% by 2030 and 1.9% by 2050 for South Africa. What other countries have done since 2006 is anything between 3, 5, 6, up to 8% of new wind capacity added to the grid in individual years, and that many subsequent years in a row. Here, the follower countries, China, India, Brazil, so part of the BRICS, they are adding in the last 3 years between 3, 4, 5% of wind capacity to their respective grid. And that again contrasts to the new build limits for wind that are part of the IRP. To look at the annual new build, the annual build out rate is one aspect, and to limit annual new build rate could have reasons like the supply chain is not able to supply this amount of gigawatts or megawatts of wind or PV. Another aspect is to cumulate these capacities and to look at the total penetration of wind and PV in the power system. An argument there could be that with a too high penetration of wind and PV, the power system is not stable anymore. Now, if we look at the same countries as in the previous slides, again for solar PV and for wind, and we just look at the cumulative figure, how much total capacity compared to their system size, then Germany is today running at 50% wind penetration, Italy at 35%, Spain 15%, the follower countries all at sitting at roughly 15%. The current IRP 2016 base case has a PV penetration in terms of installed capacity compared to peak load of just below 20% in the year 2050. So also from that perspective, from in terms of total penetration, we don't see a technical a justification for limiting the amount of PV that the IRP is allowed to build. On the wind side, the penetration levels today are already higher. Germany, Spain, and Ireland are all sitting at 60% and higher of wind penetration. Follower countries, China, India, Brazil, are knocking on the 20% mark. The IRP 2016 base case is currently limiting the wind penetration at roughly 35% by the year 2050. So with this background in the two-dimension costing of renewables and any renewable limits, I would now like to move into the IRP results and how they compare to our least cost scenarios that we are modeling. First of all, in terms of input assumptions, most of the input assumptions are exactly as they are in the IRP 2016. I'm nevertheless highlighting them here again just for to give you the full background of what it actually is, what does the system look like that we are planning for going into the future. So first of all, on the demand side, this is the electricity demand measured in terawatt hours of electricity produced per year that is forecasted from today until the year 2050, and that is the, one of the very important input assumptions into the plan. The planning assumption is that we are moving from roughly 250 terawatt hours of electricity supplied today to a bit more than 500 terawatt hours in the year 2050. So basically a doubling of the power system size is the current plan. That is an ambitious plan. On the demand forecasting in the electricity system, you always try to plan on the upper boundary of your expectations. You don't want to plan on the lower boundary, because if you get the lower, if you plan for a lower demand and you get that wrong, then you have problems with not being able to supply enough electricity. Whereas if you plan for the higher boundary and you get that wrong, then you have excess capacity, which of course has economic implications, but it's not as bad as having not enough electricity to supply. So it's ambitious. I mean, a doubling in 34 years is a high demand growth. However, just to note as well, on a side note, by 2050, with this demand, 520 terawatt hours a year, the electricity demand per capita in South Africa would still be below what Australia has today. So just to put it into perspective, what does that actually mean, the 520 terawatt hours by the year 2050? On the supply side, well, we have the situation that we have an existing stock of power supply. This is our existing coal fleet. It's the existing nuclear power station in Coburg. It's the hydropower plants that we have, the pump storage that we have, and it's now a few gigawatts of wind and solar that we have in the system as well. Now, they are all existing in the year 2016. For the modeling purposes, we assume everything to be existing that is either already there or under construction, like Medupi and Kusile, or that has been procured and has achieved preferred bidder status. So all the IPP projects that have preferred bidder status, we consider to be existing. That's the same as what the IRP 2016 assumes as well. And in this color chart, what you see here is basically the stock of existing supply fleet will come to the end of its life at some point. A large part of the coal fleet is very old already, above 30 years, and it will be due for decommissioning in the next 10, 20, 30 years. And then the solar PV plants, the wind plants, have a life expectancy of 25 years, 20 years, respectively. So over the planning horizon until 2050, all this existing fleet or large part of it will basically die out, and that's what we illustrate here. Our Medupi and Kusile are coming online until the early 2020s. That's why the coal portion goes up, and then it gradually goes down to 2050. And in the year 2050, if we don't build anything new, we basically have Medupi and Kusile and Kahora Basa and our pumped hydro. And that's all that is left in 2050. No? And what that means is if demand grows, if the supply side declines, that means there's a supply gap that opens and that widens as we go forward in time. And that supply gap is what needs to be filled with new power generators. And that in essence, that's what the IRP is doing. The IRP model fills this supply gap in the least cost manner, of course subject to any constraints that we put on the model. And to look at the magnitude of the task again, the supply gap in the year 2050 is roughly 440 terawatt hours per year. So the supply, the new power system that needs to be built is significantly larger than the power system that we have today. Just to put that into perspective, it's a very significant capital expansion that we are planning. In terms of cost assumptions, as I mentioned earlier, these costs that you see here in terms of lifetime cost per energy unit, measured as tariff or as levelized cost of energy, LCOE, these are not the exact cost inputs into the IRP model. The IRP model sees fuel costs and it sees capital costs. But these costs that you see here are basically the result of the cost inputs that go into the IRP model. Just for illustrative purposes, it's easier to explain it on such a slide than if we go into the detailed cost input assumption slide. So the resulting LCOE or lifetime cost per energy unit, as per the IRP 2016, are roughly 1 rand per kilowatt hour for baseload coal. We put everything into April 2016 rand, so that's basically current money. 1 rand and 9 cents for nuclear, 1 rand 40 for mid-merit coal and for gas, and then we have the peaking options to the very right. They are, of course, much more expensive per energy unit than the alternatives, but they are peaking in nature, which means we only use them a few hours per year, and therefore it doesn't really matter that they are expensive per energy unit. What is also important, what does matter, is the row below these costs, which gives you an indication about the CO2 intensity of the different supply options. And because CO2 is a limitation in the model, and we need to, and the model caps the CO2 emissions. So it's important to know what power generators actually emit CO2 and how much of it. So in principle, we have three different types of power generators from a CO2 perspective. We have the carbon neutral ones, which is renewables and nuclear. Then we have the very carbon intensive ones, which is coal, either baseload or in mid-merit operation, but they emit like 1,000 kilogram of CO2 per megawatt hour produced, roughly. And then we have gas-fired power station, gas and diesel in between. They are like halfway between zero renewables and nuclear and 1,000, which is coal. Now, on the assumptions for solar PV and wind, the 62 cents reflects our input assumptions, and I want to explain how that compares to the input assumptions that the IRP 2016 is using. You will remember this slide from the earlier part of the presentation. That's the comparison of actual tariffs, IRP 2010 assumptions, IRP 2016 assumptions, and what we assume for our study until 2050. We basically take the 62 cents and we connect that to the assumptions that the IRP 2010 had assumed 6 years ago. So we are basically saying, from our perspective, the actual tariffs that we see have confirmed the IRP 2010 cost assumptions. Therefore, we don't deviate from IRP 2010. We just take IRP 2010, and that basically means that we say by 2050, solar PV will cost us 49 cents a kilowatt hour. We feel that this is still conservative, because 49 cents a kilowatt hour is still more than what other countries like Chile and Abu Dhabi have achieved in competitive auctions today already for solar PV. On the wind side, again, to remember this slide, actual tariffs, IRP 2010 assumption, IRP 2016 assumptions, what we say here is, we keep the 62 cents constant over the planning horizon until 2050. So we don't have evidence to assume that IRP 2010 costs were too low. So we say, well, we assume no further cost reduction on the wind side, and we keep the cost constant until 2050. On the CSP side, we did touch on that before, but just for completeness, the actual CSP cost, concentrated solar power, are quite a bit higher than what IRP 2010 had assumed. So what we do here is we take the latest Bit Window 4 expedited tariff, 2 rand and 2 cents. We take that as a starting point, and then we assume the same cost decline, the same shape of cost decline as what the IRP 2010 had assumed in 2010. Then the CO2 limit. What you see on this slide is the South Africa's peak plateau decline objective in terms of CO2 emissions. So this is a hard constraint in the model, and the model is in any given year, the model is not allowed to emit more CO2 emissions than this number. So in 2025, not more than 275 million tons of CO2 per year, gradually declining to 2050 to 200 million tons per year in 2050. If we take all these input assumptions and now look at the results, we basically have four different scenarios that we would like to present. Three come from the Department of Energy. It's the draft IRP base case as of November 2016. Then the draft IRP 2016 carbon budget case, again as of November 2016. The difference of the carbon budget case compared to the base case is that it imposes tighter carbon reduction targets than the base case. Then the draft IRP unconstrained base case. This is a case that was run by the department as per request of the Ministerial Advisory Council on Energy. And the difference to the base case is, and the only difference to the base case is that the unconstrained base case doesn't constrain the new build rate for solar PV and wind. And then we have what we call the least cost case. This is our own model results. As of February 2017, as we stand right now, the differences to the base case, to the IRP base case, are that we don't constrain solar PV and wind. That's the most important difference. We align solar PV, wind, and CSP costing with the latest IPP results, as I've shown in the previous slides. And then we introduce that like a smaller thing, but nevertheless we wanted to highlight all the deviations. We introduced demand response by 2050 in residential warm water provision. So we basically assume that by 2050 we will be able to make the warm water provision in the residential sector completely intraday flexible. That's a small assumption, but it's an additional change to the base case. And then we take the base case results, as you will see on the snapshot, as you will note from the department's publications. And we analyze them, and we put them into a common reporting format so that we can compare the different scenarios easily with each other. Now, an important adjustment that we make is, or not an adjustment, it's just an interpretation of the numbers that we see, is the results as they are published by the department, the scenarios of the draft IRP 2016, what they show is the annual new installed capacity per year per technology. And that is, of course, very important information because it tells us how much do we have to build newly in the planning horizon. What it doesn't tell us is how much is the installed capacity, total installed capacity in the power system in each and every year, and how much energy is produced from the different supply sources in each and every year. That is shown in snapshots for decades, but not in this detail as the build-out. So what we have done is we added the existing fleet, and we added the decommissioning schedule of all the different power generators, and then we decommission all the new plants at the end of their economic life, which wind is 20 years, solar PV is 25 years, and with that we basically then can determine out of the department's new build schedule, we can determine the total installed capacity and the total electricity provision from the different supply sources from today until 2050. Now, with that introductory remark, now to the results. The IRP 2016 base case, from an energy perspective, so total electricity produced, terawatt hours per year, is a roughly one-third coal, one-third nuclear, one-third renewable and others case by the year 2050. So in 2050, 30% coal, 32% nuclear, and the rest is a mix of gas, hydro, and renewables. With more stringent carbon limits, the IRP 2016 carbon budget case is dominated by nuclear in the year 2050. So it's a 40% energy share of nuclear in the year 2050. Much smaller share of coal, because the logic is basically that the model tries to squeeze out the carbon-intensive power generators, which is the coal fleet. It doesn't build new coal or only small amounts of new coal, and replaces that with more nuclear and renewables as well. Now, in both these cases, the draft IRP cases, the amount of solar PV and wind that is allowed to be built in each year is limited, as per the previous discussion that we have shown. If we remove these limits, and then we come to our least cost case, that case looks quite a bit different. In the year 2050, we have an almost 80% renewable energy share by the year 2050, and we have a residual supply of the then still existing coal fleet, which is Medupi Kusile and the coal IPP project, and we have hydro and Kowarabasa and pumped hydro. So in essence, what happens by removing the renewable limits is that the model doesn't build new coal, it doesn't build new nuclear, it phases out the existing fleet of coal and nuclear, and it replaces any and all new build decisions are a mix of either PV or wind or accompanying flexibility, and flexibility in the form of the coal fleet itself or gas or peaking plant or hydro plants. What's worth noting is on the gas side, there's sometimes the notion that a large amount of renewables require large amounts of gas. Well, if you look at the energy balance, the amount of gas that is required here in the least cost case is 44 terawatt hours of electricity coming from gas-fired power stations in 2050. In the IRP base case, it's 39 terawatt hours, so it's basically the same order of magnitude. Interestingly, in the carbon budget case, it's actually 50% more gas that is required. It's 63 terawatt hours coming from gas that's required in the carbon budget case. So the reason for that being is that this relatively large amount of nuclear, 40% of nuclear energy share, is an inflexible type of supply. It's constant output all the time, and the flexibility that is inherently always there, that the flexibility requirements in the power system need to be catered for by the other power generators. And therefore, we need more gas in a system with a high introduction of an inflexible power generator. That was from an energy perspective. From a capacity perspective, the picture looks slightly different, because the capacities in solar PV and wind that you build have lower capacity factor than coal and nuclear. Therefore, you have to build more capacity to get the same amount of energy. And that's why in the least cost case, we have almost 240 gigawatt power system by the year 2050, 90 gigawatt wind fleet, roughly 70 gigawatt solar PV fleet, and then a large fleet of peaking plant, 37 gigawatt and 18 gigawatt of gas-fired power stations. Again, on the gas-fired power stations, you can see here the 18 gigawatt is quite a bit smaller than the carbon budget case with 33, and same order of magnitude as the base case with 22 gigawatts. But the main difference by 2050 is that there's no new nuclear and no new coal in the least cost case. In terms of the amount of PV and wind, we have done a very extensive study over the last 2 years to assess the technical potential for both solar PV and wind across the country. We don't want to go into the details of this study, also, of course, that's available as well, but we just want to highlight two results of that study. If you look at the renewable energy development zones only, and only the first phase of the renewable energy development zones by the Department of Environmental Affairs, the area that was allocated in these so-called RETs is enough area for 1,782 gigawatts of solar PV and for more than 500 gigawatts of wind. So if we were to build wind and solar PV only in the currently already designated renewable energy development zones, there's more than enough space to install the type of fleet that is planned in the least cost case. So much for our results. Now we just wanted to highlight to you that the results by the department in terms of the effect of removing the renewable limits is very similar to our own modeling results. So what we show you here comes out of the MACE presentation during the IRP public consultation on 7th December last year in Johannesburg. So there, MACE basically asked the department to run the base case with only one change, which is switching off the limitation on solar PV and wind. And the result that came back from the department is the following. So you see that by switching off the renewable constraints, the department's own model doesn't build new nuclear, and it builds 7.5 gigawatt of new coal compared to 15 gigawatt of new coal in the constraint case. So this unconstrained case by the department is very similar in its nature as the least cost case that we have run. And it basically, well, our modeling is basically a verification of the model results of the department and ESCOM. Finally, would just like to present to you a time plot, like an hourly time plot of a typical week in the year 2050, for you to get a feeling how these three very distinctly different scenarios would look like in the year 2050, how the power system would actually operate by then. So if we look at the draft IRP 2016 base case, how that would operate in the year 2050, you see that the 20 gigawatt nuclear fleet would basically run constant, with constant output all the time, as much as it can. The coal fleet would also try to run constant, because it's a base supply power generator in its nature. So, but at times when the demand is too low, or when there's low demand and a lot of wind supply, like in the night between Thursday and Friday, there's low demand and the wind supply is relatively high. That's when the coal fleet curtails and the coal fleet ramps down to make sure that we are always in balance in terms of supply and demand. And the rest of the demand, which is the black curve on the top, is then made up by solar PV, wind, hydro in blue, and the gray one is gas-fired power stations. And you can see that the gas-fired power stations are basically there to run in so-called mid-merit operations. They are there to run during the day, and typically at night they are shut down. In the carbon budget case, if we flip between these two cases, you see that if we look at the same week, so the demand is the same, it's just the way the demand is supplied is different. But you see the main difference between the base case and the carbon budget case is that the brown line of coal is reduced, the red nuclear line is increased, and that reduces the carbon emissions of that case. And then you have quite a bit larger share of gas be supplying the mid-merit operations during the day. That's on this 1 week you can see why the amount of gas that is needed in this case is actually higher than in the base case, because the variability that comes from the demand side needs to be filled with flexible power generators from gas. And then we have the least cost case and an exemplary week for that. So the way the least cost functions is that you still have the same demand. The demand is a given. We take that as a given. And now you have the large solar PV fleet in yellow. You have the large wind fleet in blue. And there are times during that week, like in the first 3 days of that particular week, when the wind didn't blow very strongly in the simulated data that we are using. So therefore, the gas fleet, the gray area, has to run relatively hard, and it's producing a lot of energy on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. Then on Thursday, the wind starts blowing quite heavily, and the 90 gigawatt of wind are producing a lot of energy. And you see that the gas fleet only produces in the morning and evening, basically. And you even have in the gray, in the shaded areas above, you have times when wind and PV together produce more energy, more electricity than what is instantaneously needed. And in our model, we assume that this energy is curtailed and it's thrown away. So we don't give any economic value to that energy. We basically say we are building these wind farms. In the model, we are building the wind farm, we are building the solar farm. We pay for them entirely. And when there are times when we don't need the energy, we throw that energy away. So just from an economic perspective, that's what the model does. So the excess energy is basically energy that we can get for free. If we can utilize that energy through something, water pumping, for example, water desalination, then we can get that energy for free and bring it to an end use. And on the very bottom, you see the residual coal fleet, which is Medupi and Kusile, and the coal IPP project running more or less constant because it's most economical to do so. So these are the three different scenarios and how they behave in nature. Now we want to look at the total cost as well. If you look at the total cost of power generation, so what does it cost us to produce these 520 terawatt hours by 2050? Then, and if we plot all three scenarios on one chart, on the y-axis, billion rand per year total cost of power generation, we see that today we come from 130 billion rand approximately. The 130 billion is roughly the cost, roughly the amount of money that it costs Eskom to run its generation fleet today. That's more or less what Eskom spends on generation. Now, two effects now. You see that the total cost of power generation increases until 2050. That has two reasons. The one is that the 132 today is still not cost reflective yet, despite the fact that we had significant tariff increases in the last years. But the more important reason is that, of course, the demand grows until 2050. If the demand grows, the total costs have to increase as well. But what's more important than the increase itself is that that the two IRB cases, the base case and the carbon budget case, are more or less the same from a costing side, with small differences in the 2030s and 2040s. But the least cost case, from the word go, from 2020 onwards, basically separates from a costing perspective from the two IRP base cases. And by the year 2050, the cost difference between the IRP base case and the least cost case on the power generation side is 86 billion rand per year. So the IRP base case is roughly 20% more expensive than the least cost case. That's without factoring in any cost related to CO2. If we take these total costs and divide them by the total amount of electricity that's produced, that basically gives us the tariff component for power generation. If we now add to that the cost for the transmission grid, for the distribution grid, and for customer service, then we end up at the average Eskom tariff as we know it today. And that's what you see on the next slide. So the average Eskom tariff today is roughly 83 cents a kilowatt hour. In all three scenarios, the tariff increases. The question is not, does the tariff increase? The tariff will increase if we want it to be cost reflective. The question is, how much does it increase? And what is the least increase in the electricity tariff? And here, in the two IRP cases, the tariff approaches roughly 1.30 by the year 2050. It hasn't fully stabilized at 130 yet, so if we were to model further into the future, 2060, it would probably go up a little bit further. The least cost case stabilizes the tariff around the year 2040 at 1.13 and then stays constant. And that's how a cost-reflective tariff should be. Once you reach cost reflectivity, the tariff should be constant, and you just keep on replacing your power system as old power generators come offline. You replace them with new ones, and your tariff should basically stay constant in real terms. And that steady state status in the least cost we will have achieved by 2040, roughly, at a tariff that is 17 cents lower than the two IRP cases by 2050. If we factor in the cost of CO2 at the proposed carbon tax of 120 rand per ton, then the difference increases to 20 cents per kilowatt hour because the least cost is also less carbon intensive. Now, in summary, if we compare the three scenarios on one slide, first, from an energy balance perspective, the base case, 30-30-30, roughly, 30 coal, 30 nuclear, and 30% everything else. The carbon budget case, 40% nuclear, and the rest split between renewables, residual coal, and gas and hydro. And the least cost case is three-quarters, almost 80% renewables, and the rest is the residual coal fleet, providing flexibility, and 8% coming from gas, providing flexibility to cater the fluctuations from solar PV and wind. On the cost side, we've seen that before, roughly 520 billion per year for the two IRP cases, 436 billion per year on the least cost case, so 82 to 86 billion less. On the CO2 side, the IRP base case, and allows us to emit. In the carbon budget case, it's approximately 100 million tons per year, and in the least cost case, it's 70 million tons per year of CO2 emissions by 2050. On the water consumption side, very similar picture, because CO2 and water is emitted and consumed by the coal fleet. So as you reduce coal, you reduce CO2 emissions and you reduce water consumption. So in summary, if we look at these dimensions, we have basically on this slide, we have a dimension clean or cleanliness in terms of CO2 and in terms of water consumption. And we have a dimension cost, which is the how much does it cost us to operate such a system. And now I think it's fair to say that in South Africa is one of the countries where this is the case for the first time, that least cost and clean is not a trade-off anymore. If we go backward just 5 to 10 years backwards, the very same picture, the renewables case on the right-hand side would have cost easily 200 billion, if not 300 billion, more than the other two cases. And at that time, 10 years ago, we would have to make a trade-off between: do we want to have a low carbon, low water system, or do we want to have a cheap power system? And we would have to find a balance between the two. Now, today, this trade-off doesn't exist anymore. The least cost and the clean is the same scenario that gives us this outcome. The last slide on the results, just to put some sensitivities to that, because you might say that this is all well and fine, but we don't agree with the assumption of the 62 cents for wind going forward that the CSIR assumes for wind cost, and we don't agree with the PV cost. We think we have to assume higher costs. That's why we put a sensitivity chart in here, and the way you have to read this chart is that on the x-axis you see the relative costing that we put as input into the model, relative costing of renewables compared to coal, to new coal. So 62 cents compared to the 1 rand a kilowatt hour means the ratio is 62% or 0.62. And on the y-axis, you see the relative costing of renewables compared to nuclear. Again, 62 cents compared to the 1 rand and 9 cents, that gives us a ratio of 0.57. And you see today, this is the one dot that shows you where we are sitting today. Our study assumptions, because we assume cost reduction for PV, the study assumptions are sitting at this big bullet. That's our assumption over the planning horizon until 2050. Our assumption in terms of relative costing of coal, nuclear, and renewables. In the third dimension, the color code now tells you what is the cost difference between least cost and the IRP base case. And we are sitting in this green area that is the 86 billion per year cost difference. Now, if you think the renewables costs that we have assumed are too low, then you can basically go into this chart and make your own assumption about the renewable costs. If you say, I assume they are 20% higher than what the CSIR has assumed, then you have to move upward to the upper right corner with this bullet, and you will still stay in the green yellowish area. So you would basically have to assume that the renewables costs are 50% more expensive than what we have assumed before we are at the break even between the two cases. So from our perspective, the least cost result is a very robust result, robust in the sense that small changes in the input assumptions will not change the outcome. That's as per the definition of a robust outcome. So in summary, from our findings, the mix of solar PV, wind, and flexible power generators is the least cost mix for South Africa going forward. It is therefore cost optimal to aim for greater 70% renewable energy share by 2050, basically to replace any to supply any new demand or replace any decommissioning plant with either solar PV, wind, or flexible power generators such as gas, CSP, hydro, biogas, demand response, whatever has enough flexibility, because that's the cheapest renewable mix for the South African power system. From our perspective, there's no technical limitation to both solar PV and wind penetration over the planning horizon until 2050. Clean and least cost is not a trade-off anymore. South Africa can decarbonize its electricity sector at negative carbon avoidance costs, because the least cost case is roughly 80 billion per year cheaper by 2050 than the current IRP base case. And that's an annual saving. So it's 80 billion per year. Once we reach 2050, it's 80 billion per year into perpetuity, because we are then in a steady state and we have this more expensive system compared to the least cost system. And additionally, the least cost mix reduces CO2 emission by 65% compared to the base case. The IRP and our own analysis factor in all first-order cost drivers within the boundaries of the electricity system. There are no hidden costs that are not captured in the IRP analysis or in our own analysis. However, they do not. The IRP and our analysis does not factor in any external costs or benefits of certain electricity mixes that are outside the boundaries of the electricity system. So job creation, externalities like the effect of CO2 other than the cost of CO2 that we put in into the post-processing. Water consumption is just reported on, but it's not an optimization criterion. Deviations from the least cost electricity mix can of course be done either in the planning or in the actual world, and with the tools that are available in the IRP and in our own scenarios, any deviations from the least cost can be quantified. So we know if we don't want to implement least cost, we want to implement a certain technology for whatever reason, CSP, because there's industrialization potential in the Northern Cape, then we can push it in. We can quantify how much do we deviate from these costs by pushing in the technology, and then the final decision makers, policy makers, can make an informed decision based on value for money, what is the scenario that we actually would like to implement. And that doesn't have to be these costs, but we think we should quantify what the deviation from these costs is. And with that, I would like to thank you very much for your attention, and myself and, of course, the whole team is ready for your questions.
People back. All your people have moved to CSI. Don't you want them back? Then we will not have these problems. Planning for different rooms. So all our brains in one room. We don't have to fight over these matters. Now we don't have to call. Let's call. DOE, President, you know when we were talking about space strategic capacity, this is what we meant.
Okay.
Not the National Planning Commission of JARA, the state strategic planning capacity, so we can bring things together. There's no need for this. So Dr. Tubby has a strong view. So we must bring them in one room the whole night and say, okay, can you prove it to us? Because, you know, for me, the test at the end of the day, honorable members, is I see the scenarios. So if we're to put each of the scenarios to the real world, which one is more optimal? Taking into account jobs, access, whether of the sources, whether it's gas or... So we have access to these things, and what are the costs? So all of that, if we were to put that to the real world and take into account the prospects for growth of South Africa in the global context, all of that, which of these scenarios? Because you people can produce any scenario, get into a little room, produce any scenario. But would they stand the test of a real world today, in the next 10 years, in the next 20 years? So I wish I could put all of you in the same room of the ESCO. ESCOM ones, the ones from President and we can have a discussion and not be fighting all over the place, because there's no need to do this. So. Honorable Makai.
Chairperson, thank you for the presentation. It's very good to get an opinion from a non-governmental agency with regard to plans around nuclear. So it really does help us create some level of objectivity. Chair, with regard to your final comments about sticking everyone in a room, you once promised us public hearings on nuclear. This is the perfect opportunity to stick them in a room and let them go at it. I just want to highlight why what the work you've done today is particularly important for what we've done today. Dr. Calvin Kim, who is now the CEO of Nexa, wrote in an article this morning that South Africa's nuclear program has attracted a great deal of public interest. This has ranged from a serious scientific and engineering interest to the emotional attacks of the extreme anti-nuclear body. The anti-nuclear crowd does not comprise South Africa only. There are Germans, Americans, and others coming here to try and derail the country's nuclear build plans. This is a man who answers, what's his favorite color? It's nuclear. What's the answer to world peace? Nuclear. So we have very convincing and forthright voices around the pros of nuclear, but we have very few people who discuss, and we're not anti-nuclear. Nuclear in the energy mix might or might not be usable, but what we are concerned about very much is the costing. So we're very glad to see that you brought some costing forward, and especially around the increase in the tariff. Specifically on the tariff, what I'd like to understand is, have you modeled the impact of the percentage increase in the tariff to the implications for GDP? Obviously, the input costs of electricity are significant. It's an input cost in the economy. If we drive up the cost up to, I think, what's the estimate you put it, almost at 1 rand 23 cents, I think was one of the scenarios that you indicated, up from 1 rand 29 cents up from 83 cents, that is a significant tariff increase that will have a significant impact on economic growth in South Africa and also, therefore, jobs and all the things that are concomitantly associated with economic growth. So one of the key questions we need to understand, one of the key findings we need to understand is, in terms of choosing a more expensive energy mix, what is the implication for the GDP of South Africa? Because that is one factor we can drive home. Because according to Eskom, they don't care because the cost can just be passed on to the consumer. The consumer will be forced to bear it. So they don't care what they build, really, because at the end of the day, they make the money one way or another. Also, just want to understand what level of interaction you've actually had with the department outside of the public hearings and consultation. I am aware that the department has to respond to your presentation and will be very keen to see exactly how they integrate some of your thoughts into their final report and also into their final modelling. Because from what I can see, and I'm not a modelling specialist, your assumptions and your findings vary quite greatly from the RP and IP inputs and leaves the department somewhat red-faced in terms of some of their calculations and assumptions. There, for example, their average tariff increase and some of the original work is nowhere near that. So it seems like we might be needing to better understand how different data sets are interacting to get to certain conclusions. I wanted to ask on that question, what are the key assumptions in the RP that you find completely problematic? Which ones are clearly unacceptable in terms of the way that's been modeled? Because there's been huge criticism from a broad spectrum of stakeholders saying that the assumptions are flawed. And this even goes into Eskom's own planning and modelling, which they're doing around why nuclear is affordable and why nuclear is the proposed or the necessary energy provider in our energy mix. Eskom also raises several issues that they constantly repeat to us, is that renewables create variability in the grid can't actually deal with variability, and this results in X, Y, and Z, you know, the world will end, electricity grid will collapse, we'll all die. You know, I mean, I'm kind of exaggerating, but that's very much one of the key issues that they're right. So where, in terms of the model and what you're presenting, in terms of the variability introduced into the grid, can the grid manage the variability? If not, what are the improvements necessary required to go to the grid, and how much is that going to cost? Because obviously that's a cost that has to be incurred by someone while we push renewables. Eskom also constantly makes the case that they need very strategic baseload. South Africa's energy demand is pretty predictable, very much in the morning, very much in the evening, and their constant argument is that renewables only produce during the day when they actually don't need it, so they're paying for electricity that they can't essentially use, and that's actually not being funded into the consumer or being used by the consumer. Eskom also maintains in its last report, I think at the end of last year, that renewables are essentially 18% of their cost base for energy generation while providing 2% of the total output. I wanted to know if you thought this figure was fair,
or realistic, as questions to Eskom have not been been answered. Thanks, Chair.
Last figure, which figure was fair?
Chair, Eskom in its quarterly report to the Public Enterprises Committee at the end of last year stated, while Mr. Molefe was still the CEO, that the total cost of electricity generation, 18% of that was associated with renewable generation, but renewables only produced 2% of the electricity output. And he was making the case that this was not a sustainable for the Eskom's balance sheet, and therefore why they were reluctant to further sign additional IPPs, and also why they were reluctant about renewables in general. So this is one of their key claims that needs to be bulldozed, Chair, if we are to get them to sign the outstanding IPPs and also to adhere to our energy policy by introducing renewable energy. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair,
any other
comments? Let me first deal with the issue of the year that we, when we disagree with the ANC, we unreasonably disagree. It's not true. You see, when they say things that we've already spoken to, and then they reason, we agree with it. Right now they're speaking that they want to amend Section 25 on the expropriation of land without compensation. We agree with that. And I'm happy that the chairperson is talking on the critical issue of bringing all these agencies in one room. Because what we are seeing is that everyone is just talking on the side of each and every department or agency or any state company. The my first issue is that the CEO of Eskom a week or two years back, he said the current IPP. Eskom is losing about 9 billion on the current setup. I want to get your comment as versus the current IPPs versus the coal generation that is currently happening. Secondly, on your presentation, I see that the wind and the solar, something that you seem to recommend as a way forward for the country regarding the issue of cost, saving of water, and all the other issues that are there. What does our landscape and our climate agrees to work with these two models? Secondly, with the issue of nuclear, on page 41, where it shows the issue of costing, it shows that solar is cheaper, wind is cheaper, and then bay and the coal is cheaper, and then nuclear becomes number four. So, if nuclear it's expensive. What does nuclear offer us as a nation except reducing? Because it's not like it's killing the whole carbon emission, it's just reducing. What else does nuclear energy offer us as a country? Because again, on page, I think it's page 38, where you talk of the demand, that even with nuclear, when it's in full implementation, we'll still have, it won't help us with any, with dealing with the demand, we'll still have the demand gap, which we need to look at other energy issues to be able to close that gap. So what is it that this nuclear is offering us? If it's not offering us cheap costs, and then it doesn't even intervene when it comes to the issue of demand. And then on page 64, you talked of the issue of because you know the country is just we are going through a serious drought as a country. Leave the interventions of Dineo with everyone else, but we are in a serious drought. But the wind and the solar, the projections here, they show that you'll use less water if you are running at 54% with wind and solar, and when coal is running at 7% and there's no nuclear. Is that the thinking and is that the recommendation from the research unit that maybe as a country, that's where we need to focus on rather than nuclear, because the nuclear from your presentation, I don't see how is it helping us, because it doesn't deal with the demand gap, but also it talks to the, it's not even cheaper to work with. So what are your final recommendations? What are you saying to us as this committee? What is the way forward according to this? But taking into consideration with what the chairperson has said, which I agree, that what are the dynamics in terms of do we have, does our climate allow that, our landscape, does it allow the wind and the solar power to be the only source in the direction of energy in this country? And yeah, in the, your summary again, it just talks about the solar and the wind. So you're not recommending nuclear and as well as the coal. What you're thinking, we know the issue of the coal, that now it's currently not the issue, more of the cost, more of the carbon emission. But on the nuclear, I want to see this, the impact of the nuclear when we introduce it in this country. How does it help us, except just reducing the carbon emission? Thank you, Chairperson.
Questions, I'll keep them for then, because mine are largely on what's the best scenario for South Africa. And so I see the scenario you prefer. So how going to, so where is the gas going to come from in the scenario you prefer? So you're saying we'll have wind. We'll have wind and PV, and then we'll have the generators. So how are we going to run the generators? Is it from shade? Is it from Mozambique? Is it from somewhere else? Is it a floating thing? Where is the gas going to come from? What are the costs? I think at some point my own view is, so can we start moving in the same direction? So when you say, hey, coal, don't have problems with coal going forward, there are major consequences for jobs for South Africa in relation to that. So what do we say? So how fast do we move? It is those things that I think we're going to have to But for today's purposes, and before you leave on our Makai, can CSIR respond to the questions? Maybe they will be follow up questions.
Thank you, Chair. Maybe first, as a disclaimer, maybe we should have stated that at the very beginning. We are not preferring any specific technology. We're not preferring any specific outcome. We are simply running a least cost model, and we put certain inputs into that model, and whatever comes out of that model is a mathematical reality, and we are just merely sharing the results of that. I would like my colleague Jara to answer the question about variability and base load when we get to that. But let me start with the other ones. So first of all, the cost of electricity, the impact on the economy. To that question, that the scope of our work is purely within the electricity system, and we produce these results. And the results say, well, the average tariff will be roughly 16 cents more expensive in the base case compared to a least cost scenario. And that's where we leave it at, because anything that goes beyond that is not our core competency, and we don't want to move out of the space where we don't have the competency. So it's for others to make socioeconomic analysis on these results. Then in terms of interactions with the DOE, the data sets that we use are actually very, very similar in some cases they are actually identical. The solar and the wind data sets, for example, are the data that we generated over the last 2 years in this large wind and solar study that I indicated, and they are used in the IRP the same as in our model. For all other input assumptions, we state with the IRP assumptions as they are. The only material difference where we have changed an assumption is we removed the limitation on solar PV and wind. And the only reason why we did that is because there's no other technology that is limited, and it's not if we go back to this overview slide of the least cost the process. So all we are doing is we are producing the least cost base case, which is purely based on techno-economical planning facts. That's all. And that least cost base case is the case that we have labeled as least cost. Whether that's the case that gets implemented is a separate question. And it can be any of the scenarios. It might be a scenario that we don't even see on this slide. So all we are saying is we are producing the least cost case. If we want to deviate from these costs, then we can quantify how much it will cost us in the electricity sector if we deviate. And then it's for the decision makers to make the decision whether a certain scenario that has implications on job creation, for example, whether the job creation potential in the one scenario is or outweighs the potential, the additional costs in a certain scenario. But we don't get into that because that's not our domain. Our only domain is we will tell you these are the different types of power systems that you can technically run in a reliable manner, and we put a price tag to it. That's it, and that's where we leave it at. So in terms of the one key assumption that is different that we have changed is the limitation on solar PV and wind. In terms of the cost, the exact numbers I don't recall the exact numbers now that you mentioned. But what I would like to show in that regard is sorry if I may just from the backup slides one thing. So what you see on this slide is the average tariff on the y-axis of the first bit windows, so it's bit window 1, bit window 2, 3, 4, then there was a bit window 4 additional, and then there was the bit window 4 expedited with 62 cents kilowatt hour. So you see the tariff on the y-axis that was achieved in the different bit windows. On the x-axis, you see the average, the amount of energy that is produced from these different bit windows. So terawatt hours produced times the tariff. That means the area indicates to you what is the total amount of money that we spend each and every year for the different bit windows. And if you now know that on the solar PV side, the only operational projects are the ones from Bitwindow 1 and Bitwindow 2. So the amount of money that we have to spend on these projects is much higher than the amount of money that we have to spend on the yellow ones, which are the ones that where the PPA is not signed yet. But we get the same amount of energy for 70-80% less money. I don't recall the exact numbers, but I think the point is that whatever is operational at the moment, these are the projects where we had to pay school fees. We collectively as South Africa, because we had to bring these costs down. And now in hindsight, you might argue maybe between the one solar PV specifically, this alone is 5 billion rand a year, every year for the next 20 years. Maybe we should have cut between the one a bit smaller, but that's... It's a signed contract. It's a done deal. So there's, I mean, yes, in hindsight we are always smarter. But what's important is the yellow part are the contracts that are not signed yet. So we have to make the decision: do we sign these contracts, yes or no? And we shouldn't base that on the contracts that are already operational. On the wind side, it looks similar, also not so dramatic as on PV, but the PV is very. It's very much these high costs in the first between those that basically make up most of this percentage. I address your first question as well. The 9 billion loss, that's exactly coming from here. So had we the first bit window of solar PV, which triggers 5 billion rand on its own, that is the main driver for the high costs that are currently facing on the renewable side. But now we have to make a decision, what do we do going forward? And going forward, we will not pay 3.65 anymore for new PV. We'll pay something between 60 and 70 cents. Then in terms of landscape and climate, I would like to show you this map here. So what you see on this map is the blue areas, the blue and the yellow areas, these sparkle plots there, are the environmental impact assessment areas where an environmental impact assessment has already been applied for by the current wind and solar PV projects. So these blue areas, and you can see how sparsely that is distributed across the country, all the blue areas together already make up 90 gigawatt of wind. So for the lack of a better representation of the impact on the landscape, this is the best that we have at the moment. If you install wind only in the blue areas, which are these small dots, then you have 90 gigawatts already. In terms of cost of nuclear and what does it give us, maybe important to note again that these costs on the right-hand side, the 1 rand, 1 rand 9 cents, 1 rand 41, these costs are exactly as they are used in the IRP 2016. These are not our cost assumptions. We take them straight out of the IRP model. We use the same costs. And now to your question, what additional value does it have outside the electricity system? That's the same answer as before. That's not our scope of work. Our scope of work is basically to inform you and to tell you what are the different scenarios that are technically feasible. And what is the price tag to them? And then you can look at these different products of different power systems that could be built, and then it's for subsequent discussions to decide, is the value of a certain scenario higher than the cost premium? But we see that we provide the fact base for having such a cost value discussion. On page 64, you referred to the water consumption. Yes, indeed, the water consumption in the least cost case is significantly less than in the base case and in the power and budget case. That attributes only to the coal reduction. The nuclear in the planning world, the nuclear doesn't consume any water because it's cooled by seawater. So the difference in water consumption, in fresh water consumption, is only because of the reduction of coal from one to the other. And then in terms of the coal the demand for coal from a job perspective and from an implication perspective for the for the economy. If you look at the least cost case, you will see that, even the least cost case doesn't plan to shut down existing coal stations immediately or prematurely. Quite the contrary, actually. The least cost, because in a least cost world, and unless you are forced to do so from carbon perspective, you would never shut down prematurely a coal-fired power station, because once it's built, it's very cheap to run. So, and that's why in the least cost case, you can see that the amount of electricity produced from coal until 2030 stays exactly the same as what it is today, because that's the least cost of doing it. All the least cost says is that if we now have to build a new power station, we shouldn't build a new coal-fired power station, because that then is more expensive than the alternatives. But as long as we have it, as long as we have operational coal-fired power stations, we should use them. That's exactly the outcome of the least cost case. And therefore, from a timing perspective, there's significant time. It's in the tune of 20 to 25 years before we actually feel a very significant reduction in the burning of coal, which then affects coal mining industry and so on. So it's not something that happens tomorrow in the least cost case. And then from my side to the last, before we move to the variability and baseload, the last question that I would like to answer on the gas side, the least cost case, the amount of gas that is needed in the least cost case is more or less the same amount of gas that is needed in the base case as well. So the amount of gas is not different. In fact, in the carbon budget case, the amount of gas is significantly higher. It's 63 compared to 44 terawatt hours coming from gas. You asked about the cost assumption for gas. The assumption there is in all the plans, that's the IRP and also our own least cost, we assume a very highly priced gas at liquefied natural gas imported prices. So not the piped gas from Mozambique, which is significantly cheaper. So we basically assume a worst case scenario for the price of gas. And in other words, how you could see this gray area as well, this amount of gas that you burn, you can see it as a proxy for expensive flexibility. So anything that can give you the same flexibility at the price of imported gas is basically in the money. And what do I mean by that? I mean demand response interventions. I mean biogas, for example. And now, us not being the experts in the socioeconomic analysis, but I think it's pretty obvious that biogas has better socioeconomic implications than importing natural gas from overseas. So if you replace the part of that amount of gas with domestic biogas, you have the benefits in the agricultural sector, and you avoid the importation of dollar-based natural gas. But in short, we have modeled it as dollar-based, highly priced liquefied natural gas in this model. And with that, I would like to hand over to these two questions about variability of renewables and the baseload. If you look at the amount of gas that is needed here, it's 44 terawatt hours on the right-hand side. On the left-hand side, it's 39 terawatt hours. So it's basically the same volume. In both cases, base case and least cost, the model tells us we need gas. And in both cases, it's highly priced. But in both cases, it stands for only 8% or 7% respectively of the total electricity demand. And because it's only 8% of the total electricity demand, the fact that it's highly priced doesn't make the case.
In the idea that the two resources do vary quite a bit, but they also have an understanding of how they vary and a prediction on and some level of uncertainty, at least on an hour ahead or a day ahead or a week ahead, on what they're going to look like. So you can plan for that. So that's exactly what, in this case, the model does, is it has an understanding of what the resource is going to look like into the future, in this case on a weekly basis, and then it dispatches the rest of the system around that. So essentially what happens here is, because of the very cheap kilowatt hours, the bulk kilowatt hours that are coming from solar PV and wind at the 16 cents per kilowatt hour, those get dispatched first, and then the rest of the system sort of gets integrated around that and provides the flexibility around that. So you can see that happens specifically at the beginning of the week, that the combined cycle gas turbines in this example provide quite a lot of flexibility. They switch on, they switch off, they ramp up, they ramp down, specifically in mornings and evenings, or have to maybe operate during the entire day. So although it's variable, the resources are variable, they're not necessarily intermittent. So as system operators have a very good understanding of what these resources are doing. Maybe just to give an example, in Ireland, it's a very small country geographically, and they have very high penetration of wind specifically. They don't have a lot of solar, but they have very high penetration of wind. And in 2016, they have an instantaneous penetration. So if you look at every hour in this plot given here, they have an instantaneous penetration, so in one specific hour, of 55% in 2016. So 55% of their electricity was met in a particular hour just from wind. And they had a very good understanding of what that wind was looking like, because they had very good resource forecasting models. They also had a very good understanding of what the rest of their fleet was capable of doing, and they valued that in various studies that they performed. They valued flexibility by saying, these generators need to ramp up in a particular manner over a particular number of hours. They have to be able to be called on within an hour or under an hour. So that flexibility inherently in a lot of power systems around the world is starting to be valued explicitly in the actual electricity market. And that's probably something that could be looked at into the future if this is something that we want to do, that flexibility and the valuation of that flexibility. So that's maybe on that. Maybe talking to grid stability. There's various components to grid stability. I think putting a blanket over stability is maybe a bit unfair, but I won't necessarily go into too many of the details here, but there's one of the key issues that's often cited is the inertia within the power system. Historically, the power system has been operated with large synchronous generators that provide a lot of rotating mass, which allows for the system to be quite resilient to faults on the network and instantaneous changes in demand and supply. Into the future, these power generators are interfaced with the grid, not necessarily with the rotating mass, but with power electronics. So there's almost a decoupling between the grid, and that then changes the whole inertia characteristic of the power system. Now, when you change that inertia characteristic, you have considerations into the future that you have to think about. For example, frequency stability. If you lose a large generator, or if you lose a big interconnector, for example, the Cahora-Bassa interconnector that we currently have with Mozambique, you have a frequency change that will then result in some levels of instability in the power system. Now, that's what the primary concern is. But it's very easy to overcome these kinds of concerns with very, if we could call it, not necessarily elegant solution for now. Examples like flywheels can be put into the power system relatively cheap compared to the overall power system to then help with the stability issue. But more than that, into the future, for example, using this plot again, we still have quite a bit of coal, a little bit of coal that's running there, but the coal that's being decommissioned, the coal generators, those big synchronous masses, can just be decoupled from the actual turbine where the coal used to be powering the turbine and just run in what's called synchronous condenser mode. That inherently then provides the system with stability, but not necessarily the power from that generator. So they just sit there and provide the stability for the network. These are options that are already being considered in various countries around the world. Maybe just to give an example, in Germany they are using a nuclear plant that has been decommissioned purely for that, just for system stability. That's one example. And then maybe dealing with the second issue on base load and base supply. I think what's important here is it is exactly that. It's a base load requirement, a base demand requirement within the power system. As you can see there, maybe using this plot again, there's about a 40 gigawatt base demand that is needed to be supplied in 2050 if you draw a horizontal line across 40 gigawatts there. Now that base demand requirement can be met with any range of supply technologies. It doesn't necessarily matter what those supply technologies are. What matters is that demand is met at least possible. And that lease cost, in the cases that we're running at the moment with the input assumptions being used, are ending up with very high levels of PV and wind, providing the bulk kilowatt hours, the very cheap kilowatt hours, and then the flexibility sort of filling in the gaps when needed over time. In the past, maybe not even that long ago, 5 to 10 years ago, this base demand was always met with the coal and the nuclear piece around the world. Turned on its head. So the whole base demand, base supply, if we could call it paradigm, is completely shifting. It's shifting away from needing base supply to meet base demand. All that you need to do is meet the base demand with a particular set of supply technologies, which is now changing because of the cost characteristics of, specifically in the cases that we're running, solar PV and wind. I think that maybe.
Questions I didn't ask today, for example, these countries are having assumptions. And these are big assumptions, and if we go wrong there, especially with demand assumptions, so if we go wrong there, we go to very difficult scenarios. But you say that this comes from the EU's space case, so I would intend we can have that discussion when we are here. So
thank you very much, Chair and Honourable Members. I think all I'm going to say is to reiterate what my colleague said at the beginning of his answer to the question, which is that at any one time we consistently put what the models and the technical work that we do on the table. The interpretation and recommendation thereof is outside of our remit. So this is our position, and it is consistent. What we have told you today in the way, manner in which we position it is what we always tell. Now, from time to time, quotations are made of our work, which is the challenge that we face. Depending on who is making the quotation or what we have said and what they themselves are wanting to say, we've often found ourselves in the very tenuous and tricky position of being associated with certain positions. I think you made the question, Chair, if I may, on a light note, that which model do you prefer? We don't prefer, because it's not our place to invade. We are the technical advisors to all of you, and we're happy to be in the room to present what we find as part of our work. Our job is simpler. Your job is harder, because you then have to say, given everything else that the country has to balance, from jobs to other things that we don't have sight of, what decisions do you then make? But we stop at giving you the technical facts. And we really appreciate the opportunity to be here today. And we appreciate the opportunity if in future you would like us to be in the same room with our colleagues. And contrary to what it might look like, we are partners on many strategic initiatives, and we work well with ESCOM and with the DOE and others. And as always, as a public institution with technical expertise on a broad range of issues, we stand ready to support you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. It's good to hear that. Doctor, the other part of the university, so I prefer to call you Dr. Tobias.
not the other two bills. Okay, that was on a lighter note about which one do you prefer, but throughout the presentation, I was under the impression that you seem to say you think this is but I have no concept of what Dr. Chikwamba just explained. I suppose I should relatively understand your position. So there's no problem. You will come next time to do the presentation. We will ask the DOE, and we're hoping that they are not going to be unnecessarily fired over these questions about what cost us from things, about what DOE's assumptions have been. So, because everything must stand the test of scrutiny, so including the work done by CSIR. So let's come back to have a discussion. It does appear to me that it is possible, at least from the side of the legislature, to develop some common understanding of how we should proceed on this big question. Well, the executive may have its own views on this, but at least we've tried to ensure that the legislature have some common understanding, have the same information, and can come to some determination on how to proceed on the issue of the future energy mix that we're discussing from a scope point of view. And as Honorable Jumino was saying, I'm sure I can be able to win him over and over. To my position, not as if you're winning me over to opposition. Yeah, no. No, thanks very much. I think we will call you again next time to come here. Because you don't normally finish this early. I think we're quite efficient. So members of the public, perhaps from DOE, presidency, from everybody else who's here, members of the media, thanks very much for coming. And thanks for making time to come make the presentation, Dr. Manchi. Thanks a lot. The meeting is adjourned.
Okay.